This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes. Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S. and the second most common killer of people between the ages of 15 and 34. Those numbers have been creeping upward, with more than 41,000 people in this country taking their lives in 2013 alone. But federal funding for suicide research is only a fraction of what's spent on other health concerns. This morning, in the latest segment of our occasional series, Suicide, A Crisis in the Shadows, WBUR's Lynn Joliker looks at what some researchers are doing to try and prevent suicide.
And so if you click begin, you'll see the word suicide appears, so you hit the left side of the screen. Now the word living appears, you hit the right side of the screen, and so on and so forth.
Up on the 12th floor of a nondescript concrete building in Cambridge, about a dozen Harvard University researchers spend their days trying to crack the code of something that's eluded scientists for decades.
We're really lacking in our ability to accurately predict suicidal behavior and to prevent it.
Psychology professor Matt Nock runs this lab, which focuses entirely on suicide and self-harm.
We are really struggling with identifying which people who think about suicide go on to act on their suicidal thoughts and which ones don't.
One tool that might help with that is the Implicit Association Test, or IAT. The computerized test asks patients to quickly classify words related to life or death, such as thriving or suicide, as being like them or like other people.
For suicidal people, they're faster responding when death and me are paired on the same side of the screen. People who are non-suicidal are faster responding when death and not me are paired on the same side of the screen.
Nock and his team are evaluating the test by trying it out with patients in the psychiatric emergency room at Mass General Hospital. The study participants also answer questions about addiction, mental illness, and suicidal thoughts or behavior. Nock is collecting larger sets of data by offering the IAT and questionnaire to the public online.
Our next question is, how do we give the information generated by these tasks to clinicians in a way that will be useful? Do we give them a number? Do we give them a probability that a person's going to make a suicide attempt in the next week or month or several months? And that is not as simple as it sounds.
With a $1 million grant from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, Nock and his team are combining data from their word association tests, people's medical records, and even apps the research participants are using to record real-time information about suicidal thoughts or self-harming behaviors. Study subjects also undergo blood work to identify genetic markers that may increase the risk of suicide. But Nock and other researchers point out that despite widespread reports about a suicide gene discovery last year, there are many genes that might play a role.
There are genes that turn things on, genes that turn things off. And so it's a very complicated process.
Clinical psychologist Jill Harkavy-Friedman says she hopes to someday have tools to better predict her clients' risk of suicide.
We may not be able to control if they think about it, but we can help them control what they do about it.
Harkavy-Friedman is the vice president of research for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. She says with better diagnostic tests, she and other clinicians would be able to put emergency care plans in place for those at imminent risk and teach others how to divert their attention away from their suicidal thoughts.
Then we can teach them alternate strategies for coping with those situations. And it does have an effect on the brain because the brain is very dynamic.
These are coronal slabs of the brains.
The complexity of the brain has been driving neurobiologist Victoria Arango and other suicide researchers at Columbia University for decades. Arango studies the brains of people who died by suicide and compares them with brains of people who had depression but died of other causes and those who didn't have mental illness. The Columbia scientists have collected 800 brains, which they store in giant freezers. With powerful microscopes, they study the tissue down to individual cells.
The black things are neurons, and the serotonin is stained black.
Arango says though the field of suicide research started late, she's heartened by one major conclusion.
That there is nothing like mental illness. It's not an abstract thing. It has a place of residence, and is the brain. That suicide is a disease of the brain.
She and Columbia psychiatrist John Mann discovered more than two decades ago that the neurotransmitter serotonin doesn't transmit as well in certain areas of the brain in those who died by suicide as compared to other people. They've since pinpointed the exact location of that abnormality in the brain, which they say is the key.
When you look at the brain of a person who died by suicide, what you have is less serotonin going to a part of the brain that is involved with decision-making or with controlling impulsivity.
That may help explain why some people view suicide as a way to quickly escape their pain. Psychiatrist John Mann.
The relief from the psychological pain of depression is worth more to them than the possibility of relief from treatment that's going to take weeks.
Mann and his colleagues are finding similar abnormalities when they scan the brains of living people who are suicidal. And they say the degree of the brain abnormality is directly proportional to how lethal the person's suicidal behavior is. But researchers are still years away from possibly translating those findings into diagnostic tools doctors can routinely use. In the shorter term, Mann sees promise in a medication that's producing stunning results and powerful reactions from patients in a clinical trial he and his fellow Columbia scientists are conducting.
Best I've ever felt. Haven't felt like this for years. I'm scared it's going to come back. Comments like that.
The drug is ketamine, which doctors have long used as anesthesia in people and animals. Researchers are studying it as a treatment for severe depression that doesn't respond to other meds. Mann says he thinks ketamine has the potential to save lives.
In my view, this is the most exciting discovery in the treatment of major psychiatric disorders, particularly mood disorders, in the last 20 years. When it works, people don't get 20% better, 30% better. They get 60, 70, 80% better, and it works in a couple of hours.
Ketamine is also abused under the name Special K, and in trials, the drug can produce some psychiatric side effects that disappear within a few hours. Right now, doctors can only administer it intravenously, but some pharmaceutical companies are conducting trials on oral and nasal spray versions.
We put a couple of electrodes underneath the eye here on top of this muscle.
Back in the Nock lab at Harvard, postdoctoral fellow Cassie Glenn is focused on suicidal behavior in adolescents. She's studying how much a teen startles by blinking when hearing bursts of white noise at the same time images appear on a computer screen. The pictures range from puppies and babies on up to scary things, including a snake, and images that imply someone might be about to take his or her life, standing on train tracks or looking down from a tall building, for example. Glenn's early research has found teens who have attempted suicide startle less at the pictures related to suicidal behavior.
The individuals who go on to attempt may have a reduced fear of death. So it's not that they just have this desire to end their lives, but they actually may be less fearful in engaging in these kinds of behaviors.
Psychologists say experiences such as childhood trauma or drug abuse might contribute to someone being less fearful of self-harm or death. Just some of the many factors that add to what researchers call a cocktail or a storm of influences that can come together to make someone suicidal. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Lynn Joliker.
To find suicide prevention resources, including crisis hotline numbers, go to our website, WBUR.org. There you'll also see Harvard researchers demonstrating some of the diagnostic tools they're developing.